Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, and that must mean it is true crime time. And in a startling change of direction, it actually is true crime rather than a Hollywood noir one. And once again on Friday nights, when I do this, I'm joined by Jen. Jen, how are you?
I'm good. I'm here. It's been a good Friday. This is an awesome story. And yeah, it's not technically Hollywood, but it should be.
It should be.
Someone needs to cover this, you know, film-wise.
I'm going to tell you that I told Jen this. I got like 50 pages, and I know Jen's got thousands of pages on this case. And I came up with my suspect like in 30 seconds. And I'm not sure that I've actually changed my mind on that. And it's going to be fun to talk it through because I want to see, because you always know more than me about this stuff. So it's going to see if you can point me in a different direction. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about this case and Mary Shotwell Little, which is quite the name.
Yeah, quite the name, quite the lady. When I came to NC with this case, I told him, I said, you know what? Forget the Wolf of Wall Street. You know, you've got to help me out here. Who in the heck is the Wolf of CNS Bank? You know,
yes.
I'm looking at basically maybe two murders, but
yes,
we're going to get into just the first, Mary Shotwell Little. This was 1965, October 14th. She'd vanished from this picturesque location, which was Lenox Square Mall in Atlanta, Georgia. And back in the day, it was considered to be just an upscale place to where people just didn't go missing. You had this basically false sense of security, and you could just come and go as you pleased. But this woman disappeared around 8 p.m. at night. She had met a coworker for lunch, and she had also done some shopping in the area while her husband was out of town.
Yep. I think that one of the things that, before we talk about maybe like how she died, what I found, first of all, what I found fascinating when I was doing this and when I was reading it, I was like, we've been doing so many cases in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s that to do one where it's the late 60s and they actually took blood and things like that, I was like, hold on, I totally forgot. This is the late 60s. And, you know, they're actually doing some crime scene stuff rather than this 20s and 30s and 40s stuff. Now, it doesn't mean that they didn't screw everything up and lose everything. But at the same time, we've done so many that I was just like, oh, wow, they took the blood. They could match the blood and all this kind of stuff. And it was a nice change of pace. One of the things that I think is kind of the background to this and something that I was reading about some of the police and when they interviewed people is it appears at this time that this bank was kind of going through a purge of everybody suspected of being gay or lesbian.
Yeah, there was some weird situation going on to where there was a witch hunt for homosexuals. And then in the background, there was also perhaps maybe a alleged club to where if you were homosexual, then they'd want you to join up with them and maybe climb the ladder. Those are just two different, just totally separate things that could have been happening at the bank. You know, the hunting of homosexuals and then the joining up of. That part to me will always be confusing, and it doesn't seem that anyone has ironed that out.
You know, to me, it kind of seemed, and I'm glad you brought up both parts, because it's kind of like in Hollywood, the gay mafia, right? So everybody who's gay, we're going to protect you. And, you know, especially it was more of a necessity back when coming out was going to ruin your career. And so there was this gay mafia, and we're going to help everybody. But at the same time, if you didn't want to join the gay mafia, then we can't trust you, and so we're going to get you out of the
that's
business.
That's true. Yeah, if you were not.
So I kind of felt like it was the same kind of way in the bank. You know, so there's these higher-ups, and there's this club. Okay, if you join, great, we're going to help you. If not, then you're not going to have a job. And try and say anything, we're going to tell everybody that you're gay and you're living in Atlanta in the 60s.
That is perfectly put, because it does sound like that if you did not play by their rules, then perhaps they would out you. They could even invent a story about you that would ruin your career, possibly forever. But with Mary Shotwell Little, she was originally from Charlotte, North Carolina. So she had moved to the Atlanta area and pursued this bank job. She had a degree in secretarial sciences from the University of North Carolina. And her goal was to move to New York, not to Atlanta. But her family thought that Atlanta was safe. So they told her, hey, move there. So that's how she ended up there. And some of her roommates actually from the University of North Carolina moved with her. And they had actually moved out ahead of her. So how she landed this bank job was through a high school friend. And that woman helped her get one of the most coveted positions at CNS Bank.
Yeah, I mean, she worked with the executives and everything, and it was a really good job. And now I read that she made about $400 a month, which doesn't really sound like a lot. However, if you think about minimum wage for even into the 1980s, and I think even into the 1990s, you know, it's like $3.35 an hour. So, you know, with 120, she was making, you know, well more than the minimum wage. And her husband, who we'll talk about in a little bit, I mean, he was making a lot of money. I don't know if he came from money or just his job, but when you're buying your engagement rings from Tiffany, you know, you got a little bit of money.
Oh, yeah. Back in the day, if you had Tiffany, you were definitely considered upscale, and her husband had a military background. You know, he's a Citadel graduate, so as far as, you know, has his home life, how he grew up, I don't know if he came from just a really wealthy family, but it just seems like he made well after he got out of his Army career, basically, and then landed the bank examiner job.
Yeah, and this bank examiner job, he was out of town 80% of the time. And Mary, you know, she's 22 and she had been living with roommates, and then she gets married and she ends up being bored all the time because she's got nobody there. But she, you know, she chain smokes Kent cigarettes, which is aggressive. And, you know, and she was reading and dancing, love TVs and movies and everything like that. And so she starts this job in 1962. And like you said, she has these roommates that she knew, and most of them worked for the bank. Not all of them in the same branch or anything, but they all kind of worked, you know, in the bank. And, you know, it seems, you know, what we'll talk about in next week with this possible second connected murder, what I found interesting was that your roommates didn't like when you said that you were going to get married. And I feel, and it happened in both of these situations, and I don't know if it's because, and there was actually a third person that's not, in this. I think it was, somebody else who was talking about it. They were a witness, and it just seems like at that time, you know, if you had two women roommates, somebody was always looking for another roommate because somebody was always getting engaged and married. And I just thought that that was kind of a little interesting side note, but I mean, they seemed more. Everybody brought it up that they were upset that she was leaving. And I wonder if it's because they were going to have to find another roommate, or that she was breaking some kind of covenant or something like that.
Okay, well, she went to that University of North Carolina. The branch that she went to, I read, was some type of all-women's school.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting. And then she moves in with the women roommates that are also from North Carolina. They kind of all fall in together into these Atlanta banking positions. You know, it's just female, female, female. And I'm not by any means saying she's a lesbian. There's nothing wrong with it if she is. But if it played into her murder, it's going to be important. But the fact that the women got so upset that they refused to go to her wedding when she wed Roy Little, no gifts, no wedding. I mean, who gets so mad that they're like, you know, I loved you for all these years. You're a good friend, but I'm abandoning you now. I'm not coming to your wedding.
That
seems a little
more
extreme than shopping for a roommate, right?
Especially one of the roommates she had known since high school.
Yeah. So how do you sever that relationship unless there's just something?
Well, there's something going on because
deeper.
You know, her husband called to invite her to a football game, you know, in the beginning of November, 1964, right? And they start dating around Thanksgiving, and then all of a sudden they decide that they're going to get married. You know, I think it's Christmas time or something, and New Year's Eve, or they got engaged. And that was kind of fast for that time period, I think, even in the late 60s. Maybe that had something to do with it. And also, her roommates really hated the husband.
Yeah, they didn't like him. They called him surly, said he had a really bad attitude. I don't know if they just blamed it on the fact he was a military guy or if he was just Was he older than her and just stuck in his ways? I don't know, but they didn't like the guy. And I, too, thought that she got married very quickly and perhaps looked like maybe she was running from something. You know, yeah. If you can hurry up and marry up, you can say, you know, look, see, I'm married. You can't talk to me anymore. I'm a totally different person.
Mm-hmm. And it was within 10 months of their first date that they got married. And what I found interesting was they got married on September 4th, 1965, and then they honeymooned, okay? And they honeymooned for about 36 hours. So, I mean, this was something, I mean, they went back to work on Monday. They got married on a Saturday, and they went back to work on a Monday. And, you know, I just found that that was kind of, I mean, he was getting this new job, so he had to be there, but it seemed all kind of rushed. And then when you see his reaction after he finds out that she's dead, it just makes you think that this whole relationship is maybe not true love.
Yeah, I looked at it as, is it a lavender relationship? Is it just her trying to hurry into something? She never really liked him that much to begin with. But, you know, he is the husband. He was out of town legitimately. He was away 100%. For a week in LaGrange, which is 20 miles south of where Mary would have been. He had a solid alibi. He really was working for the state banking department and, you know, all that stuff checked out. But when she disappeared, he literally, when law enforcement said, you know, she's missing, there's blood in the car, he just shrugged his shoulders like, eh, and then wanted to know when the car would be released back to his custody.
So he That's could, all he cared about was getting the car back.
Yeah, he just wanted to go to work. That was it.
Now, that you answered a very important question. Because I kept meaning to do it, and did not do it. And I did not know how far LaGrange was from there. So you're saying it's only like 20 miles.
Yeah, it's like 20 miles back then, because, I mean, traffic wasn't horrible. Now it would be about 30. So, I mean, he was a good distance away from her.
But it's interesting that even though it was only 20, it was 20 miles away, that, you know, that he stayed in the hotel for a week. Rather, you know, nowadays I think people would just, people commute for, you know, an hour and a half each way. So what I was always wondering when I was reading it was, would he have had time to, you know, go kill her and then go back to where he was staying? Because
anything's possible, especially back then when they didn't have a very good record of where people, you know, were at any given part of the day anyways, you know, unless they were staring at him at all points during the day. I mean, anyone can slip away, but since they were sharing a car, you know, 'cause he's all about getting his car back. It sounds like that he got a ride down to the banking place.
Then how did he get back so quick? Did that same person give him a ride? Because never hear about that.
Yeah, I did not read about who brought him back, but that he did come back in a hurry once she became missing and her bank boss, you know, basically called him and said, hey, you know, your wife is MIA.
Yeah, and then it makes me wonder, so he wanted the car released and, you know, and we can circle back to this, but are we sure that they only had one car?
It appears so.
I mean, because
it
was
a new car,
you know,
a 1965 pearl gray Mercury Comet.
Mercury Comet.
You know, and when you read that, you're like, long ago.
Because if they did have a second car, and I was thinking, well, he just wants it released to himself so quickly, and then I'm wondering, you know, does he want it so then he can clean up any evidence or something like that?
Well,
you know, so that's
what I was saying. That bank boss went looking for her at her apartment complex in Decatur because she didn't live like exactly near where the CNS bank job was. She lived in Decatur, which is a good ways. And the bank boss said that he did not see her vehicle in the parking lot. So I tend to think that that Mercury Comet was just their one vehicle.
Okay. So we have October 14th, 1965. And well, first of all, for newlyweds, you know, they have not been married for very long when this happens, right? What are they've been married for a month, okay? And so he goes for his business trip on Monday, and he checks in the motel. And then the next night, Tuesday the 12th, he talks to his wife for a few minutes on the phone around 8:30 p.m., and she has a friend over. And that's the last time he ever spoke to her. So this is a newlywed couple that's only been married for 6 weeks and got married after 10 months. So you would think, oh, my gosh, they are just so into each other that, you know, this is newlywed. Oh, my gosh, you know, I love you. But he doesn't even talk to her on the 13th, and he doesn't talk to her on the 14th. I mean, obviously, you know, she was working on the 14th, but didn't talk to her in the morning or anything like that. Did you find that kind of odd that they would go a couple of days without talking?
Yeah, I find this entire story to be odd. I mean, she knew when she was marrying a bank examiner, he would be gone 80% of the time because the banks that he had to deal with, you know, they were outside of the, you know, the main thoroughfare of where not only they lived, but where they mainly worked. So she knew she'd be alone a lot. Was she carrying on other relationships? And that's why she wasn't real concerned with her husband. I tend to think so. I'm not blaming her for it or shaming her by any means, but I just tend to think that maybe something else was going on.
I think so too. But, you know, with the background of the whole, you know, the women, and I'm wondering.
Here's the thing about her. Okay. Did you read about her undergarments? All right, it's 1965. When you go back and you read what color bra did women wear back then? What color panties? Red was kind of off limits. Black was kind of off limits. It was considered really scandalous.
Yeah,
and Mary was a
black.
Little, she's a little haughty. She had on the black bra, you know, the black panties, the girdle, the slip. I mean, she was, you know, she really liked the lingerie. It tells you a lot about her.
Yeah. And I mean, she was on the pill because that's how the husband knew that she hadn't spent the night there. At the house because he saw that she hadn't taken her pill, which I, you know, that's something that he picked up on right away, which was kind of interesting. I'm like, oh, let me check to see, you know, that was, I thought was kind of interesting. So she worked until 4:45 p.m. The day, you know, that she ended up getting killed. But before she leaves, she cashes a personal check for $25, which seems, you know, if you're making $380 in a month. I mean, she's taking out 8% of the money that she makes in a month just for this night. You know, that's kind of interesting.
She was spending money like crazy right before she died. She was buying furniture. She was buying clothes. So he must have made really good money.
Exactly. Plus, they had a brand new Mercury Comet.
Yes, and the law enforcement said while he did look hinky in his behavior, and yes, victims all behave differently, but he did act weird. However, the life insurance policy that he carried on her, they said he didn't need because he already had plenty of money.
Yeah, and hers was not very, very large. So it was definitely not money motivated by the husband. I think if he killed her, he killed her, but it wasn't for money. And. Yeah. So she's meeting a friend from the bank for dinner and some shopping at Lenox Square, which I guess at that time was, you know, a mall, but not the kind of mall it is today.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't a mega mall. It was like a quaint open air type of shopping center where it, you know, it's just a more open and happy environment.
So she goes grocery shopping, which I find really, really odd. But this is before she's going to go meet this friend for dinner. It's 70 degrees outside for the high temperature that day. And she goes and buys four bags of groceries. I'm assuming that some of those groceries were probably perishable.
I mean, they'd had to have been. And I'm glad that you brought that up because I listed that under this big, huge thing called problems on my notes is that who shops, like literally grocery shops, and then puts the bags in their car in Atlanta. You know, because the temperature, it can be hot 1 minute, it can be cold 1 minute. You just never know. And then go in, you're going to go feed yourself, you're going to eat, and then possibly shop with your friend while your groceries are just rotting away in the back seat. No woman does that.
It made no sense to me whatsoever. And it's not only just, you know, so they went to dinner and all that kind of stuff. And then they said that she went to the grocery store because she was expecting company over the weekend, and she for sure bought groceries and everything. And I mean, it was implanted in the car later or something because the store clerk had been tipped 10 cents, by her, and he, you know, totally remembers. So she puts the groceries in the car and then she meets up with her friend from work at 6:15 PM. And then they eat and then they go shopping at a department store and they finish about 8 o'clock at night. And this is where it gets kind of weird. To me, is that the both of them are parked in this lower level of a parking lot just outside a department store, but that's not where the car ends up. And I just you know, it's a little bit weird to me. But meanwhile, so Roy, the husband, he said that he went to his hotel room after dinner, got there about 6:45, watched some beers and, drank some beers and watched some TV until about 11. So, he's got this gap from 6:45 PM until essentially the next day.
Yeah. See, when someone would not have eyes on him. So could he have made it there and done something? I mean, yeah, sure. Anybody could have, but yeah. So she's out with this Isla Stack, her coworker. They eat lunch at the SNS cafeteria. They shop, they come out at 8 PM. Some people had said that Mary expressed that she had been a little uneasy about being alone, not only at night just recently, but also alone in her car. If that's true, why is she walking out at night at 8 p.m.? It says her and Isla split. They went separate directions. The fact that Isla knew where Mary was parked is kind of weird to me, because I might wave to my girlfriend and say, hey, see you tomorrow. But I mean, I'm not really looking to see. She's parked in the yellow zone. She's parked in the 32 parking place. You know, that seems like a lot of information.
It does.
Because this coworker goes on to pass that on the next day when Mary doesn't show up for work. You know, she's able to tell the boss of the bank, you know, just all this pertinent information.
That is something that I found very interesting. And also the fact, now we should probably bring up that the reason that she might have been feeling uneasy or scared was she had received 5 roses at work anonymously. And there are several people who reported, I don't know where her office was, but it's interesting. All these people who are applying for a job, they could hear Mary on the phone.
Okay, yeah. So you can hear everyone's business, because I've checked out the story kind of high and low. So they're at the Mitchell Street location. It's their human resources office. Uh-huh. And you can just overhear the women talking on the phone, but you can't hear, of course, what the person was saying to Mary. So someone overheard her say, you know, I'm a married woman. I can't come over there and see you, but you can come over here and see me. And what some people believe that means is not that she was inviting someone over to her home per se, but just at that Mitchell Street where she was working, all of the main banking office executives, they were housed only a few blocks from Mitchell Street. So if they wanted to come over and just kind of say hi to you or hang out at your cubicle, they could. So that could have been a thing.
But she couldn't go over there. So you think, because when I read it, I was thinking, okay, coming to the house, but she couldn't go over. But you know what you're saying makes much more sense, because of course she could have gone over to somebody's house, you know, because who's going to know?
See, an executive can come and go as they please. They make their own hours. But since she was working at an operational center, she's the main personal secretary, highly coveted position. She can't leave her seat, period, unless she gets permission from the bank boss, which he's going to be like, why do you want to leave? I'm sure going to make out with somebody is not going to be a good reason.
Or was it that you could go over and see all these men if you were single, but once you were married, they had to come to see you because you don't want anything to look untoward?
Sure, because when those 5 roses showed up, you know, people were looking at her saying, you know, you're a married woman. The card is not from your husband, because, I mean, allegedly the card was, you could just tell it was not from him. And she was trying to play it off, but she was also acting scared. And then behind the roses was the strange phone calls, and people just said it sounded not heated, but just like they made her really uncomfortable.
Yeah. And one thing I found towards the end, and so I'm going to be a little bit vague because I don't remember exactly. This is a ton of information, and it is it's still what Atlanta's most popular unsolved crime, right?
It is, yes.
Yeah.
The only one that trumps this, you know, this is the most popular. People lean into it. The Atlanta child murders would be number 2.
Okay. So one of the things that I read, and it was kind of vague, and I'm going to be kind of a little bit vague about it, but there's a woman who on October 1st said that she had been raped by a guy. And I don't know if it was he caught her when she was in her car at her place or whatever, but he had told her, you know, while he was raping her that and made her do uncomfortable sexual acts, I believe was what they said, or uncommon or something like that. That he said, yeah, I've been watching you for a while and all your friends. And apparently she was a friend of Mary.
Really? I had not heard that story. See, things like that are important. I did read about the bum in the parking lot that would run up to women even on the night that Mary was shopping. See, at Lenox Mall, the big box store in that mall is going to be Rich's. So Mary was shopping at Rich's. Her coworker Isla was shopping at Rich's allegedly with her. But there was another woman, someone they didn't even know. And her name was Carol. She was shopping. She came out around the same time as Mary. So she was approached by a man who may have or may not have been a bum. The man tried to open her car door after she got in. And he was like banging on her door saying, "Your back tire's low," just trying to get her to get out of the car. Well, she drove off because she knew better. She pulled into the service station and the attendant checked her tires and said, "Ma'am, there's nothing wrong with your tires." So she reported that to law enforcement.
Yeah. And I thought that, you know, if you were going by something like that, to me, you know, now this woman who was a friend of Mary's, who said that she was, you know, raped, and he did not bring up Mary's name. He just said, you know, "I've been watching you and your friends." And it did not say, I don't think, whether she worked in the bank or anything like that. You know, this woman could have had a lot of friends, you know, could have had 100 friends, and one was Mary. So to me, you know, it's a tip, and it's interesting because we have a guy who's, you know, raping this woman and saying, "I've been watching you and your friends." So, you know, if he's been watching, then he could have easily been watching Mary too.
Well, yeah, because I was looking at those statistics. I didn't see any rapes in the stats. It doesn't mean I didn't miss it, because I could be an idiot and miss something. But then there was a second woman who reported to APD. This is all Atlanta police jurisdiction, by the way. Edna. She came forward and said that she was at Lenox Mall a week prior to Mary being there. She was approached by a man who knocked on her window and was also trying to get her to open the car doors. So was there a man targeting women at Lenox Mall during that time? Possibly, but my problem with this is, why did no women turn up dead? He would have eventually been successful. You know, if he's the guy that killed Mary and he's the guy that goes on to be a person in our second case that we talk about, why did he never strike again? Why only those two women? And it's totally two different killing styles, if you ask me, because one is completely missing.
So something that happens later in the night. Now, but police don't discover it for a month, because that's how things worked in the late 60s, is that sometime between midnight and 2:30 in the morning on October 15th, Mary's gas station card, which had her husband's name on it, was used for gas in North Carolina for a car with stolen plates. And those plates were stolen, I believe, from a college student or something like that. And in the car, there was a woman lying on the front seat with blood on her clothes, an injury on her head, and a road map covering her face. And she never left the vehicle, but she signed the credit card slip. And so I'm trying to picture how that would have happened. She's holding the map with her left hand and then, you know, signing with the right. And she signed it Mrs. Roy H. Little Jr. The reason that they knew the plates and everything was because back then, you know, you're not swiping a card or anything. You know, you're doing the little imprint or your handwriting. And when you did that, you're writing down the license plate of the car in case, you know, it doesn't go well. And so then you have a way to track down this person. And then it was used again. So that was right outside of Charlotte. And then it was used again outside of Raleigh. And somebody reported that, you know, she was even more bloody at that point.
So now we have possible sightings of Mary being taken out of Atlanta, where she was currently living, and now back to her hometown area, because she was from Charlotte, North Carolina. So why is she back in her hometown? Weird things about the car, which I'm glad you brought up. The thing about the charge card was that when they processed her car, it was covered in a thin red dust, which it's Georgia red clay. That's just what it is. So it proved that her car had left the mall and drove on a dirt road at some point. Inside her car was those groceries that you were talking about. So she did shop. There was also Coke bottles kind of strewn in the car, her Kent cigarettes, blood on the steering wheel, blooding feet, fingerprint on the steering wheel. There was dry clippings of blood stuck to the headrest. All this stuff's important. Rolled up neatly between the bucket seats was her girdle, her panties, which Atlanta police said were recently worn. So they knew that, you know, she had just taken those off, and she rolled them up just so nicely and stuck them between the seats. Does that sound like maybe she was buying some time, that she was stalling whatever was going on in the car?
Maybe, and also her bra was there, but not her dress.
Yeah, her dress was missing, her keys, her engagement ring, her wedding ring, anything of value, and her, the highest value of all, that was all missing.
One of the things that I saw also when they were talking to people was there was another woman who said that she saw Mary leaving alone in her car around 8 o'clock from Lenox. And the reason that she knew that it was Mary, not that she knew her personally, but she was also driving a brand new Comet. And so, you know, when you have a car and it's brand new and you see another one, you look at it because you know, all of a sudden you're trying to spot them. And so she saw that and it caught her attention. And she saw that Mary was driving alone at that time.
Yeah. And I totally understand that. Cause if you have a rare car and you see another car, you're like, oh, they've got my car. And then you kind of want to wave at them or whatever. So I totally get that.
So then the question I have at that point is we do not have, Mary does not go back to her apartment. So this theory of this guy that was following around the women and then raping them, or at least the one person, there's no way where he is getting a hold of Mary if Mary actually drove away by herself. And there's no way that, you know, he's getting Mary back at the apartment because she doesn't go back to her apartment.
Well, yeah, and plus that guy, to me, sounds like the motive of a rapist. He's going to get you right then. He's going to have his fun with you right then because he doesn't want to take any chances on anything ruining that fun. So he would rape and then dump. So if the report you read is correct with whoever reported that, and I'm not denying that it happened at all. I'm just saying it just sounds like a different motive. If that guy rapes and he doesn't kill, which thank God that
exactly.
woman survived. But
exactly.
Inside of Mary's car, there's all this blood, right? Or so
but
to
it's not,
appear
yeah.
it. You know?
They made it look like it was a ton of blood, but the police or the detective said it was about what you would get from a bloody nose.
Exactly. They said it was made to look like the foul play was way worse than it was. You know, staged to look extravagant, perhaps as if someone had died. Okay, well, my thing is that if you want us to not look for a live Mary, why are you swiping her card in North Carolina? Because it has Mrs. Roy H. Little. They knew that that would come up as activity on the credit card, and it would also be physically mailed to the husband. It would show that she was perhaps alive in North Carolina. Those two things, they cancel each other out as far as purpose.
So we have the morning of October 15th, and everybody sees Mary's husband at breakfast at his motel around 7 a.m. So you have from 6:45 p.m. when they finish dinner till 7. So he's got a good solid 12 hours where he's not accounted for. And then they all go to the bank in LaGrange at 8 in the morning. However, Mary obviously does not show up for work at her bank. And she, I guess, is always on time. Her old roommates say that she used to stay out all night, but no matter what, she would show up for work on time.
Yeah, she was a punctual person. And also when you start talking about Roy having the gap of when people saw him, and her car really was missing from Lenox Mall because when security went to look for it, it wasn't there. And so it was dropped back off in broad daylight. And that's brazen.
It is. And this is also, again, it's not like today if you live around it's not this mega mall. It's fairly tiny. And the security officer said, hey, I ticketed some cars that were parked there overnight. That's what I do.
I read back then they were crazy. That's how they made their revenue. They would ticket the hell out of everybody that left a car. So, I mean, she didn't have any tickets registered to her tag.
Nope. You know, and so they would have done that. They would have hunted it down. It's like if you live here in Los Angeles and you go to LAX and you have expired tags, you're going to get a visit from the LAPD motorcycle cops because that's all they do is patrol every single one of those garages looking for registrations that are expired. That's
and now they all have tag readers, so it's 10 times worse.
So you have this. But now what I found fascinating, and this is my suspect. This is the one that I came to 30 seconds in.
Give it to me. Who's your suspect?
Gene Rackley.
Okay, then. The big guy.
The big guy, her boss. The reason is she doesn't show up for work. This is your boss. And now we don't know anything about their personal relationship or anything like that. But this is her boss. And she doesn't show up for work. And he calls her apartment, but no one answers. And what does he do? He doesn't, you know, what would most bosses do? They go, well, I'll call back in another hour or whatever, because this is not a time of cell phones, pagers, or anything like that. I'll call back in an hour. You know, she could be sleeping, she could be sick, whatever. But what does he do? He goes over to her apartments, and then the property manager lets him in to check on her, the boss. This person that the property manager doesn't know from Adam. But no one's home. And so then Rackley calls Roy just after 10 a.m. And again, this is interesting because I'm not sure. I guess he called the LaGrange Bank maybe or something, because this is not a cell phone thing. So this is going to be a complicated procedure to find out exactly where Roy is. Because Roy doesn't work for CNS. Roy works for the state. And so how exactly did Rackley know where Roy was?
Exactly. Rackley seems to know everything about everyone.
That's the part. And it's just kind of blown over. If you look at any kind of, you know, whatever, because research on these things or digging around, Rackley's got a lot of, my big question is, this is Roy Little. It works for the state investigating banks and doing audits on banks.
Yes. And Mary, prior to her disappearance, don't forget, had told people, I have something to tell some of you. Like, it's important. You know, you're going to want to hear this. And then she disappeared.
Yes. So somehow Gene Rackley knows where Roy was. Now, maybe Mary told the person that she went to dinner with the night before,
if they actually went to dinner. Isla suggests that Mary told her a little bit of everything about married life, about where her husband was. I mean, you name it. So that ran the gamut.
So let's say Gene figures that out or finds it out. So then he calls at 10 o'clock in the morning to find out if Roy had spoken to Mary the night before, and they talk for about 5 minutes. And then Rackley says that he'll call Roy back in about a half an hour. But good on Roy. Or maybe he's trying to cover himself. But he hangs up the phone and immediately leaves LaGrange and heads back to Atlanta. And he drives straight to their apartment. And that's when he discovers, okay, she didn't sleep here. Because, again, the birth control had not been taken. And nothing in the apartment is out of the ordinary. Nothing's been moved. Nothing like that. And so what happens while all this is going on is Rackley goes over to the Lenox Square Mall looking for Mary's car, because he knows that's the last place Isla said, you know, and again, we're taking Isla's word that they were there and Isla's not in on this or something like that. And then this is the part that's kind of interesting to me. So he calls Roy at 10. They talk for 5 minutes, hangs up. Okay. And, then Rackley either goes straight to Lennox or he goes to the apartment and then goes to Lennox. But at no point does he really cross with Roy, as far as we know. So he has a lot of time for some stuff here. And so he goes around and he's not finding it. And then around noon, he finds a security guard, you know, and this is again, you and I have done, you know, cases like this. You want to find somebody to be your alibi, to make it seem as if they're discovering something. So he finds a security guard standing on a sidewalk outside the cafeteria, says, hey, will you help me look, you know, for this car? And then 15 minutes into looking, oh, there it is. There it is. And it's Fawcett who finds the car. It's Fawcett who opens the car door and leaves his fingerprints on the door. And sees the bra on the floor and bloodstains in the seat. So then, oh my gosh, I got to call the police.
Yeah, so there you go. You have your new fall guy whose name will appear in all the police reports, and the guy who is maybe allegedly, not blaming him, but could be, orchestrating all of this. You know, he knows the moves of all the players, where everything's going to be, what time. So when he drags in other people to be witnesses, like you said, it's always the perfect timing of the witness being there and saying, yep, I saw that, you know?
Exactly. My theory is that Brackley went and got the car. And then brought it over. And it was close. It was close to wherever. And maybe, you know, he had this all planned out. He knew that he had time. He knew that, I guess, Roy was far away. He knew that he was going to have time to move the car over there. Because nobody knows that it's missing, right? Nobody knows that nobody's looking for the car. Right?
Yeah, one's looking for the car. And also, how would they have known unless they spoke to Isla or had spoke to Mary herself. How did they know that she was at that mall late at night to begin with, where she was parked, when she'd be coming out to have the opportunity to grab her anyways?
So to me, that's what happened. And another fascinating little tidbit from the late 60s, and you can see that Roy is probably taking some kind of IRS deduction for mileage because he has a mileage book. And he brings it out, and the police and Roy kind of determine that the car had been driven about 40 miles total. So that includes probably Mary going to work, you know, then Mary going over to the mall, and then whatever happened. So, you know, it hadn't been driven a long way. And that's just their best guess. It could have been a lot less than that.
Oh, yeah. So, in contrast to where she lived and where she worked and then where she, you know, ate that night, 41 miles to me is not that bad. That seems about right.
Yeah. So then a patrolman gets there about 12:30 in the afternoon and a couple of lieutenants. And then they speak to a different security guard. And this is the one who was on duty between 12:30 and 8:30 in the morning. And he says, definitely, without a doubt, that Mary's car was not parked in this yellow section between 4 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock in the morning, which means that Brackley could have any time after eight. But, you know, I'm guessing that the mall probably didn't open until around 10 o'clock in the morning. What time did Mary have to be at work? Do we know? Was it eight?
Yeah, I think it was 8 a.m. Okay. That's the time that I read.
Okay. So what I'm guessing is that, you know, at some point Brackley manages to either have somebody drive it. Or this is, you know, there is a gap in my, you know, story because, you know, 8 o'clock. So you have the security guard. Nope, wasn't there. It wasn't there. It would be, you know, between 4 and 8. So it had to happen between 8 o'clock in the morning and 10 o'clock in the morning. Well, even when did Brackley exactly get called? Here's when he did it. So she doesn't show up. He rushes over to the Belvedere Apartments where she lives, gets the property manager. I need another alibi. They let him in, check on her. No one's home. So then at that point, he goes and he takes the car to the mall. Then he calls Roy just after 10 a.m., just after 10 a.m., just after the parking lot opens, just after the mall opens and people start driving in.
See, this is a guy who knows what he's doing, and he covers all of his bases and perfectly always drags someone into this.
Yes. And the crazy thing is, and we're going to talk about it in the next episode, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but I have to ask this question because I don't remember the answer. Is the person that we're going to talk about next week, I know she worked in the same position and everything, but did she work for the same guy?
She worked for the same guy. She sat in the same chair. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, Jen, this is a good one.
Oh, she had the same roommates. Should I carry on? Nope, next week.
I know. It just, oh my gosh. So they found all these things. They found the white slip, the white panties, the white girdle, and then the black bra. And, you know, the blood it's on the surface of the front seats, but just a tiny little bit, and mostly on the passenger seat. And I think that if you, so that's where, you know, the whole 12:30 in the morning when they're getting gas, the person's in a passenger seat or whatever. And there's blood in the passenger door window, some on the outside of the driver's door. See, that's the part that doesn't really make sense because we have this tiny amount of blood. And so, you know, it's okay.
Yeah, they make it sound like she was accosted in the car and they made her slide over. And, you know, that kind of explains the bloody fingerprint that they were able to lift from the steering wheel. And then since there was no CODIS back then, they had no way to run it. And they ended up losing.
Let me ask you about that. Yeah. Before we stop for this. So that fingerprint, I guess, the one on the steering wheel,
yes,
is the one that has been teasing investigators for 50 years.
Well, it can tease, because it's gone. They lost the majority of her evidence, and the reason is because when Atlanta police, they had 165 Decatur Street, 175 Decatur Street, they had two massive floods. That's a property room. It's like central records. It's evidence. It's all kinds of stuff. It was ruined. The majority of that stuff was allegedly thrown out. It was not salvageable. And then they moved to another building on Ponce de Leon. That had an asbestos scare. So you had homicide and everybody having to pick up, move all over again. You have files, boxes everywhere. Things are constantly getting misplaced. They're not getting put back. And it's not really like low accountability. It's just there is so much stuff and they're moving so much. And that's what you don't want in a department is massive moving. APD is huge. They cover a lot of ground. So that's why her file and stuff are missing. But with the evidence today, we could do a lot with that stuff.
Yeah, because, you know, they checked all the fingerprints and the only ones they found were hers. Okay, that's the other thing. So they found hers and then they found the security guards on the outside on the door handle. They could never identify the bloody print on the steering wheel. I don't recall, and perhaps you can tell me, you know, because obviously there's thousands of pages I could have missed it. Roy's fingerprints weren't in the car.
Well, this was 1965. I don't think that CSI was the greatest, and I'm not by any means dogging them. I just don't think they're the greatest at what they were doing. I saw a lot of things that were wrong. I read that the homicide detectives that went on to post online called themselves out for a lot of things that went wrong. They couldn't even decipher really what were Mary's fingerprints. You know, her blood type, yeah, it was ran through at the crime lab, but they were just able to say that it was most likely Mary's. You know, they couldn't say for sure. They just didn't have all that scientific technology that they have now. And, of course, all the DNA and stuff, it's now lost. Her fingerprints are on file, but she's skeletonized wherever she is. So that's not going to really be helpful.
No. And they but never mentioned Roy. If his fingerprints weren't in the car... This, again, goes to my thing. Then maybe they did have two cars.
Well, you know what? We'll look into that. Like, I will look that up the way I can to see if they have any vehicles that were in their name at that time and see. But I've always just seen them refer to the Mercury Comet.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting. Again, like you said, they didn't do the greatest job.
No, I love your line of thinking though, because why didn't they mention the fact that the husband's prints were also found in the car? Because then we would have said, yeah, you know, of course, because they shared a car.
Exactly. And, you know, it's kind of, and, you know, frustrating. Now, here's the thing that I also, before we go, and I keep saying before we go, but there was parking tickets inside the car, indicating that it was not parked there prior to 9:30 a.m. Okay, so 9:30 in the morning. So the person who brought it got there a little bit after 9:30 in the morning. You know, they you know, however, you know, you ended up having to pay, so they knew. So, you know, 9:30 in the morning. So then you have Brackley, and he called Roy a little after 10. So you have for sure 40 minutes. And the car's not that far away. So, you know, I'm pretty much all on Brackley. I'm not sure why at this point, but I'm you know, what the motive is. But we can definitely, you know, talk about
because
that.
She's basically his personal secretary. Personal secretaries, they knew, like, if you worked at a bank like this, they knew your business. They knew everything about you. They were the go-to. You know, they were the ones that had secrets, you know, living in their hair. So maybe that made Mary a target. Maybe she didn't even know what the heck she knew that got her whacked. But I think Rackley is as good a suspect as any. I like him more for this than I do the husband.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing that's interesting is all those four bags of groceries, they were undisturbed. They didn't lean, you know, nothing happened. They didn't move, it looks like, an inch.
Was she chain smoking in the car and drinking some Coke, though? I mean, what's with the Coke bottles being strung?
There's two Coke bottles, and they're going to be glass, right? So they're just kind of bouncing around in there. You would think that, okay, are you worried that they're going to break or anything like that?
I'm worried why we didn't get some swabs, or why they didn't bag those Coke bottles. But I guess it wouldn't matter at APD because it all would have been washed away or thrown
away
anyways.
But maybe back then they could have, you know, it says, and again, so I just looked and it said, several other fingerprints were lifted from parts of the car, but they all appeared to belong to Mary and to Fawcett, the security guard. So, you know, we got more to talk about Mary, and then we also have our second victim next week. And like I said, this is really, really good. You guys really don't want to miss next week because it's fascinating, fascinating. Jen picked a really, really good one. Anyway, we will do that next Friday. And Jen, once again, thank you so much. I appreciate it. You have found a choice case.
I'm glad you like it, and thank you for having me. Always an honor.
Always. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye, everyone.